The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You know, Al-Qaeda is just propaganda. They reach nothing. They talk a lot, but they reach nothing. We might say, well, they have different strategies and tactics. They don't speak about the caliphate. They speak about emirates, and we might discuss about it. But to them, it's too much talk, too little accomplishments. Whereas the Islamic State, you see these guys. They are now even re-establishing the caliphate, our ultimate goal. So this is galvanizing people on an individual base, and not just on other types of motivation, but also introducing this very powerful motivation based on rational expectation, rational calculus, which adds to the other more salient motivations among individual jihadis in Europe, which is identity search.
That was Professor Fernando Renares you just heard, a senior analyst on international terrorism at the Elcano Royal Institute in Madrid. Last week, Professor Renares spoke about his new book, entitled in English, Kill Them, Who Was Behind 311 and Why Spain Was Targeted. The talk covered the March 11, 2004 Madrid bombings, the rise and shape of jihadist networks in Spain, and the evolution of terrorism in Western Europe. He highlights that like much of the West today, Spain battles the challenge of jihadist radicalization and recruitment networks that are sending fighters to join the wars in Syria and elsewhere. Bruce Riedel, director of the intelligence project at Brookings, provided introductory remarks and moderated the conversation. It's the Lawfare podcast, episode number 85, Fernando Renares on the Madrid 311 bombings and the future of terrorism in Western Europe.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Brookings Institution. This is the latest event in the Brookings Intelligence Project, which I think some of you are familiar with. The Brookings Intelligence Project spends a lot of its time looking at the issue of terrorism and counterterrorism. That is why I am particularly glad today to have as my guest my friend and colleague, Fernando Renares, Spanish scholar, to talk about the issue of terrorism in Europe. You have his biography in the handouts that we gave you. He is a professor. He is also a senior analyst at the Elcano Royal Institute in Madrid. And he is also the author of a fantastic new book. I am not going to read the title in Spanish and humiliate myself in front of all of you. The title translates as Kill Them, Who Was Behind 311 and Why Spain Was Targeted. I believe that this will be the definitive account of the attack in Madrid in March of 2011. That attack, of course, was the worst terrorist attack in modern European history. Almost 2,000 people were killed or injured, the majority of them obviously injured in that attack. It is an attack that has bedeviled analysts and researchers for a long time, and I think you are going to have the pleasure this afternoon of getting really to the bottom of it. The terror threat in Europe, of course, though, has not ended, We still live in a world, perhaps not of the old Al-Qaeda, but certainly of Al-Qaedaism in all of its manifestations from Morocco all the way to Indonesia. Attorney General Eric Holder was in Europe this weekend, and if you paid any attention to what he said there, he portrayed a terror threat environment which is quite alarming, with the establishment of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and the transmission of terror technology between the various Al-Qaeda franchises. He said in one of his events that he has never saw a threat environment as worrisome in the 5.5 years he's been Attorney General as he is seeing it today. And the greatest manifestation of that threat is, of course, in Europe. So today what I'd like to do is spend some time looking backwards to 3/11 and trying to find out what really happened in Madrid in that attack, and then moving forward and looking at the current situation and hopefully at the future threat situation in Europe and in Spain in particular. So with that as our game plan, let me ask you to do two things. Think of whatever questions you want to have, because I'll open it up to you in about a half an hour. And secondly, please turn off your cell phone so we don't have any embarrassing moments when we all listened to your ringer. With that as introduction, let me start with 3/11. There was a lot of confusion at the time as to who did it, who was responsible. There was a narrative that developed afterwards that this was a local plot, or at most a Spanish-Morocco plot, that it was had really no connection to the larger Al-Qaeda universe. Tell us where you come out on that very interesting question.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And thank you very much indeed for supporting my research since the very moment that you first heard about that. And thank you all for coming here today. The 3/11 attacks in Madrid, which caused 191 fatalities and over 1,800 people injured, were the product of 10 to 13 terrorists, members of a network mainly composed by three main clusters, and that network was directly linked to Al-Qaeda's external operation command, headed in those days by Hamza Rabilla, through an individual whose name was Amer Azizi, a Moroccan who used to be member of the Al-Qaeda cell established in Spain in 1994. And actually, without knowing about the Al-Qaeda cell established in Spain in 1994, it is almost impossible to make sense of the 3/11 attacks in Madrid. And I emphasize that because still today, many American friends and colleagues who are fully aware of Al-Qaeda's whereabouts in London or in Hamburg miss the point that Al-Qaeda also established cells and circles in Milano and Madrid before 9/11. And after 9/11, it became clear to the police and intelligence services investigating the attacks in New York, in Washington, and Pennsylvania, that there was a connection between the Hamburg cell, the Mohammed Atta-led cell in Hamburg, and the Al-Qaeda cell in Spain, led in those days by Abu Dada. Still, many Americans, for instance, even if interested in 9/11, are not familiar with the fact that Mohammed Atta came to Spain just a few weeks before the attacks to complete preparation for the attacks, among other things, to pass Ramzi bin Alvish the precise date that bin Alvish was charged with handing over to Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, which bin Alvish did. And by the way, he did so traveling once again from Germany to Pakistan, Afghanistan, via Madrid, where he got the fake documents he used for his successful travel back to the south of Asia. Now, if you allow me just a couple of minutes, I say that the terrorists were part of a network. By network, I mean that the individuals who belonged to this terrorist network, some of them were moving by themselves, but others were members of groups and organizations. So the case of Madrid is different in this sense from the London case. And the three main components of this network were, first of all, the cluster of individuals who were formerly members of the Al-Qaeda's Abu Dada-led cell in Spain. After information confirming that Mohamed Atta had these contacts with Abu Dada and his cell in Spain, Spain decided to dismantle the cell. That was November 2001. Spain arrested over 30 people belonging to this particular cell. The six individuals were not arrested. One of them was not arrested because he was in Iran in those days, managing the trial that the individuals he used to radicalize and recruited in Europe followed to reach Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan. He was Amer Azizi. But five other individuals, latecomers to the cell, actually they joined the cell throughout 1999 and the year 2000, were not arrested, despite long investigation on the part of the security forces in Spain. They were not arrested because under the legislation that Spain had in those days, most of the now terrorist offenses they were involved in were not considered crimes. And what happened? Those individuals were not only those who started the Madrid bombing network, but also the individuals who played the key roles in the local operational cell. The decision to attack Spain was adopted in Karachi on December 2001 by Amer Azizi, who, from Iran, since he wasn't able to go back to Spain, they were waiting for him, moving to Pakistan, and he was with a Moroccan operative, Abdelatif Mourafik, the very day he took the decision. This decision was ratified in a meeting held in Istanbul on February 2002, a meeting attended by delegates from the Moroccan Islamic Combatant Group, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and the Tunisian Combatant Group. Why those delegates? Why those groups? Because those were the groups that lost everything in Afghanistan and had to change the strategy. And they decided, as from now on, we will target not only inside conflict zones, but there where we live, there where militants reside. That decision was critical for Morocco first and for Spain afterwards. Morocco, May 16th, 2003, when, by the way, one of the targets was a highly symbolic Spanish target, the Spanish house, the Spanish restaurant in Casablanca. And it was also critical for Spain. And you know that individuals linked to the Casablanca attacks were also linked to the Madrid attacks by means of the Moroccan Islamic Combatant Group. So as a result of this, the individuals who were not arrested in Madrid, despite being members of the Abu Dada cell, started the formation of the terrorist network with the determination to target Spain on March 2002. Throughout the year 2002, as a result of the Istanbul meeting, the network incorporated a second component, a second cluster, that was introduced by the Moroccan Islamic Combatant Group. Now, not from Morocco, but from the structures that the Moroccan Islamic Combatant Group had in those days within Western Europe, and in particular in France and Belgium. It is not by accident that within 2 weeks after the Madrid bombings on 11 March 2004, the Moroccan Islamic Combatant Group cell in France and the Moroccan Islamic Combatant Group cell in Belgium were both dismantled. And there was a third component in this network. But the third component was not introduced until the summer of 2003. That is when the plans were already there, when the network was already present. The third cluster was totally unexpected. I am referring to a group of individuals, 10 individuals, who were members of an ordinary criminal gang led by a Moroccan known as the Chinese. He wasn't Chinese, he was Moroccan, but they call it Chinese, the Chinese, Jamal Hamidan. He was in prison in Morocco. He left prison on June 2003, came back to Spain, although he wasn't allowed to do so, resumed contact with his former followers, and he was by then extremely radicalized. Extremely radicalized. It's not that it all started with him in Morocco while in prison. He was already radicalized when in Spain in 1997-98. He was already showing, exhibiting radical Islamist radical behaviors. Among other things, he used to tell prison authorities in Spain that he had been chosen by Allah for an important mission to lead Muslims. And so he came back to Spain and gathered his people and decided and convinced them and radicalized them in a very fast manner to join the network which was already, as I say, was already there, established and ready to act. I'd like to emphasize this, Bruce, because for a long time the Madrid train bombings had been reduced to this third, last, unexpected component. But this component only added logistical capabilities, manpower, financial possibilities, and also help to find explosives. Actually, the network before this last cluster was introduced into it, the idea was to use TATP to perpetrate the attacks. It was only when the Chinese and his gang joined the network that they said, why to explore? Why to take risks with that? We can find explosives because we have contacts. We were in prison. We know individuals who are trading explosives, and we have drugs in vast amount for this purpose. So they acquired the explosives, and that was one of the main functions they had. But as I say, by then, the decision was taken. The network was organized in the two main clusters, the one coming from the Buddha Dasel, the remnants of the Buddha Dasel, and the one coming from the Moroccan Islamic combatant group. And note that the decision was adopted and the network initiated its formation long before the Iraq War.
Right.
And long before the general elections were called in Spain.
That's exactly, you've anticipated where I wanted to ask you next. The decision then to attack Spain is made in Karachi 2+ years before the attack. But by coincidence or whatever, it turns out the attack is on the eve of the Spanish national elections. And arguably may have changed the outcome of those elections. There's been a lot of speculation that that was the intent of it. I think your research conclusively proves that that's reading backwards in history. But would you say there was no correlation? Did the network see an advantage in doing this at this particular time? Or was it purely by coincidence that they ended up doing it that way?
It was by coincidence that the elections were finally called just 3 days after the attack's date. The date was decided in or before October 19th, 2003. We know that because one of the documents, I used a number of sources for the book, police, judicial sources from 7 different countries, intelligence sources for up to 10 countries, Al-Qaeda documents. And one of the documents I have in the book comes from the investigation the Belgian authorities conducted after the arrest of the individual who was the Moroccan Islamic Combatant Group node within the Madrid bombing network, Youssef Belhaj. At the time of his arrest, there were 2 cell phones over his night desk, 2 cell phones. And those cell phones were operated with SIM cards, prepaid cards. In those days, not in Spain, but in Belgium, it was already compulsory when you buy a prepaid card to provide your identity. However, he managed to fill the request, providing a false birth date. Mm-hmm. And while purchasing the prepaid card using one of the 2 cell phones, on October 19, 2003, he wrote down a fake birth date. And he wrote down 11 March. Mm. Interestingly, the other cell phone was acquired just a couple of weeks after that, and he again gave another fake birthday. This time was May 16th. So he wrote down the date for the past Casablanca attacks,
right,
and the date for the coming attacks in Madrid. Now, this is the first notice that we have about the precise date for the attacks in Spain to be decided. For the date. Now, the decision to attack in Spain. The decision dates back to December 2001. So, October 19th, 2003, the general elections weren't even called in Spain. Now, by then, Al-Qaeda's senior leadership had endorsed, approved the ongoing plans. Why? Basically for 2 reasons. Amer al-Sisi, remember the individual who was a key member, a core member of the Abu Dada's Al-Qaeda cell in Spain, was not arrested because he was in Iran, and he escaped to Pakistan. There in Pakistan, he went to join Al-Qaeda Central. They knew him very well. He had been in Pakistan, in Afghanistan several times, at Al-Mawri Abu Yahya training camp and at Al-Farouk camp. Mm-hmm. He was very well known among his peers in Afghanistan, within Al-Qaeda. So he had no problems to join Al-Qaeda. Over 2002, he became a field commander in Afghanistan, under the command of individuals very well-known Al-Qaeda commanders. Then he joined the propaganda apparatus, working alongside Mohammed Bahaya, the only 9/11 terrorist who is not arrested, not his death.
Right.
Interestingly, Mohammed Bahaya is now married to Amer al-Sisi's wife. Amer al-Sisi died on December 1, 2005, and I should explain you the circumstances surrounding his death very quickly. So the emir, Osama bin Laden, was extremely pleased with his work. He was a bright guy, very smart, college-educated Moroccan, who had spent time in Madrid doing business. So in addition to managerial skills and operational skills, he knew Europe. He had been in Europe. He was established in Europe. He became the contact between Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda's operatives in Europe. And the emir decided that he was to be Hamza Rabilla's second, or they call it adjunct. So Amer al-Sisi became adjunct to Al-Qaeda's operations, external operation commander at some point in early 2003. So this made it possible for him to offer the ongoing plot to Al-Qaeda senior leadership. And Al-Qaeda senior leadership decided to support the plot after the Iraq war started. What initially was a decision adopted by revenge, by vengeance against Spain. Remember that Spain, after 9/11, no other country became so harsh, right, in prosecuting Al-Qaeda and jihadists in Europe as Spain. The dismantling of Al-Qaeda cell, I know that in America it's easier to go and see what went on in London, what went on in Germany, what went on in France, but no other country was as strong as and tough against Al-Qaeda and jihadists as Spain. The year before 2004, only the year before, nearly 50 individuals were arrested in Spain for jihadist terrorism offenses. And the Al-Qaeda cell dismantling was the strongest blow to Al-Qaeda in Europe post 9/11. So this revenge on the one part, and the fact that Al-Qaeda senior leadership understood that the ongoing plot could have important strategic outcomes for Al-Qaeda is what led the emir and Amar al-Zawahiri to finally endorse and support the plans, the terrorist plans. And they thought that there was a formula to, in addition to revenge and vengeance, there was a formula, if successful, to create divisions within the international alliance in Iraq, to generate divisions between populations in Europe and their own governments with respect to Iraq and Afghanistan and other places. And what they do was something unusual. The very day of the attacks, at 7:30 p.m., Al-Qaeda sent a message to someone who was used to receive message from Al-Qaeda, Abdel Bari Atwan, the editor of Al-Quds in London. And that message was claiming responsibility for the attacks in Madrid. Interestingly, blaming Spain for two things. First, we have all scores to settle with this country. An interesting clue concerning persecution of Al-Qaeda and dismantling of Al-Qaeda. And then Spain being part of the US-led alliance against Islam, as they literally quote. So what Al-Qaeda did was to seize the opportunity. They usually don't come forward with statements of this kind that quickly. But after the elections were to be held 3 days following the attacks. After the elections, on a document dated March 15th, the elections were held on March 14th, they again sending a message to Al-Quds, but also posting this on Global Islamic Media website. They say, the reason why we took the decision that we normally are not used to claim responsibility so quickly is because something, the circumstances changed with respect to the moment we took the decision about the date. And what is it that changed? Elections. So we intervened to make the most of the attacks carried out successfully in the country.
I think this is very clear in the narrative you develop, but I'll make it even more explicit. What we see here is an Al-Qaeda core and an Al-Qaeda cell in Europe planning intensely for a long period of time with a very strategic thinking. I think that is a lesson that the 3/11 incident should be seen for understanding Al-Qaeda in general, that it is not an organization of bloodthirsty maniacs. They may be bloodthirsty maniacs, but who just take any opportunity they can, but rather a very deliberate and strategic thinking organization. Now, you mentioned the demise of the mastermind. Where and how did he come to an end?
Amer al-Sisi was killed as a result of a drone strike in Haishori near Miran Shah, which is very much in the news these days, on December 1st, 2005. The decision to strike, al-Sisi was not the target. The target was Hamza Rabija. And why was, I believe, authorized the action against Hamza Rabija? Because, and this is not that I believe, it's in one of the documents I quote in my book, because Hamza Rabija was planning something similar to London and Madrid in public transportation system of a major U.S. city. Hamza Rabija and Amer al-Sisi were both already training operatives for that purpose. This is when, or shortly afterwards, is when intelligence services of at least two countries knew about Amer al-Sisi. Until that moment, no one had any idea that Amer al-Sisi was so high in Al-Qaeda's external operations command. He was referred to as Ilyas, as Al-Maghrebi, Al-Andalusi, but no one knew exactly. In fact, is that the first, I don't know if I ever told you about this, but it was late 2008, that is 2 years after the criminal proceedings in Spain were completed, and 1 year after the convictions were handed by the National Court in Spain. Late 2008, I was in the UK, And got news about an Al-Qaeda director of operations, as they call it, and his assistants that were being convicted by a Crown tribunal in Manchester. And among other things, the sentence says that those individuals were in contact over the year 2005 with the purpose of perpetrating an attack in South Africa with top Al-Qaeda members, including Hamza Rabilla and Elias the Spanish. That was found writing in invisible ink in one of the notebooks that the those individuals had at home when the British police arrested them. Elias the Spanish. Rusi director was called to testify and say that Elias the Spanish was likely Mahmoud Arkansali, an individual formerly related to Abu Dada's Al-Qaeda cell in Spain. But I was surprised about that because I knew Arkansali was in Germany and was on welfare and was not possible for him to leave the country because he's being claimed by many countries, including Spain. He was not handed over to the Spanish authorities because of a problem that the Germans had with the implementation of the Euro order in the country. So can be Arkansali. So who was Elias the Spanish? And I finally found out that Elias the Spanish was Amer al-Sisi. So that helped me to go back to the criminal proceedings, to the Casablanca proceedings, and many other sources throughout 5 years, to now being able to confirm that not only he was the mastermind of the Mahdi bombings, but he even traveled from Pakistan to Spain via Turkey in late 2003 to finalize the preparations for the plot, for the attacks. And by the way, here in the U.S., a lot of people is asking me, but why then, if Al-Qaeda was so much involved into this, why is it that the attacks were not suicide attacks? Well, first of all, the Madrid bombings were part of the plan, but the plans were not finished. The terrorists, they rented a safe house in Leganés near Madrid, where they had the idea to stay for 1 month or 1 month and a half, but they rented a house, you know where? A full house, you know where? In Granada. The most emblematic of all Al-Andalus cities. Right. And the last to be lost. And this Al-Andalus idea is pervasive in the test reading meetings that the Madrid bombing network had in Madrid time and again. Besides, we recovered at least two testamentary letters by two members of the network. When they were surrounded by the police on April 2004, the weeks after the attacks, they took the decision to call their fellow ones, their families, and say, we are ready to become martyrs. We are ready to become martyrs, so this is the time for us. And those who escaped, you know what they did? They went to Iraq. They joined Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And at least three of them perpetrated suicide attacks in Iraq, claimed by Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The way they escaped from Spain to Iraq using the networks established for that purpose, for the purpose of sending recruits, European recruits to Iraq, by the Moroccan Islamic Combatant Group in association with Ansar al-Islam.
I think the audience, I hope by now, knows what I've known for a long time about Fernando. He is a detective par excellence in taking the key pieces of information and then being able to put them together to explain the bigger story. And I think that not only does this shed enormous new light on 3/11, it sheds important new light on 9/11 as well. But I want to fast forward now a little bit. As I said at the beginning, Attorney General Holder said that he has never seen threat reporting of the nature that we are seeing today. You look very closely in your hat at the Elcano Institute at the status of jihadist volunteers flowing from Spain, other European countries, to Iraq and Syria. How do you see that picture, and how is it developing in front of you?
The picture is certainly a worrisome one. If I have to emphasize a couple of issues, perhaps during questions and answers, I will be able to add new ones. I have to underline a couple of things concerning the jihadist threat to Europe nowadays. I will say this. Coming back for a moment to the Madrid bombings. After 9/11, we got it wrong with respect to Al-Qaeda threat and jihadist threat. We got it wrong. I still don't understand why it became so popular to say that following 9/11, Al-Qaeda was nearly out. Global jihadism became an amorphous movement, and the threat was coming mainly from independent cells and individuals. Even the intelligence community thought that way. Remember after the London bombings, all the authorities came to say this was an independent cell, right, unrelated to Al-Qaeda Central, which proved wrong. And it took me a bit longer to find out the connection with Al-Qaeda Central, which had been, under all the conditions, that was not my duty, by the way, as a member of a think tank, but the duty of the security services in Spain, which should have been continue investigations on this particular issue after the criminal proceedings were closed and the sentence decided by the National Court in Spain. So, and in the Madrid bombings, we have individuals. In the Madrid bombings network, we had individuals who were in Bosnia, who were in Afghanistan, who were in other conflict areas before they joined the network. So, first lesson, we know that it might take time, but individuals trained or who went there or with experience abroad might become over time key players in preparing and executing plots inside Europe. And secondly, same as when the Madrid bombings took place and the London bombings took place, we got it wrong with respect to the nature of the threat. Nowadays, Bruce, I think that we are overestimating, maybe because it's fashionable to do so, the threat coming from independent jihadists, from the so-called, I don't think we should call them that way, because it provides them kind of a glamorous, you know, the lone wolves. Independent jihadist individuals with no historical, personal, or organizational connection with other jihadist actors. We are overestimating this because the main threat over the past year, the major threat over the past year, came from individuals linked to organizations or belonging to cells linked to organizations. And for instance, take the case of Spain. Since the first jihadist was arrested in 1995, the year the first jihadist attack took place in Europe, and by the way, against commuter trains in Paris, not against the metro, against commuting trains. Until the present, close to 100 individuals have been convicted in my country for jihadist terrorism offenses or died as a result of one act of suicide terrorism on Leganés. Now, none of them is a lone wolf, not even one. We have no isolated independent individuals. 80% of them, 60% of them, were part of cells linked one or the other way to Tehrik-e Taliban Pakistan, the Moroccan Islamic Combatant Group, Ansar al-Islam, and so on and so forth. 20% were members of organizations, apparatus, Al-Qaeda, Moroccan Islamic Combatant Group, and so on. And some 20% were members of independent cells, So 80% of all those convicted in Spain belonged to something which was well articulated and organized. Although sometimes policemen and judges have trouble to understand the way that they articulate themselves. And they are doing so many different changes from the old-fashioned terrorists, like the Mahdi bombers. Why is it that many of the Mahdi bombers were known to the police? They were following their phones and so on, but they were not using those phones for that purpose. You know what they did? Why every time one of those individuals was arrested and say the police found a huge number of cell phones? Why? Well, they were using huge numbers of cell phones and huge numbers of prepaid cards and changing those constantly. Why? So as to become opaque to the security services. Or the way they used to communicate by email?
No. Tell us.
They use email a lot. But the idea was they all had the same, I mean, the nodes within the network. That means three people plus Assisi. The way they do it was you type a message into the draft box. You leave it there. Someone will open the email at a different location, will read the message in the draft box, will erase that message, and will write the reply in the draft box. So you never have email traffic. Very smart individuals.
Very smart.
So they learned this where? Probably Al-Farouk. But among the many people I had the opportunity to interview, and they were very, very different people. For instance, I had the fabulous occasion to interview with witnesses, of course, to interview Abu Abdullah al-Sadiq, the leader of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, the very day he was released from prison in Tripoli, just to get his confirmation about his relationship with the Tunisian, the local ringleader within the Madrid train bombing cell, the Madrid train bombing network, which he acknowledged. He didn't want to talk that much about it. He said, well, those were social relations. Well, so the Tunisian, an independent, unrelated individual, was talking over the phone during the 2 months before the attacks with Abu Abdullah al-Sadiq, and this is not relevant? Right. And Abu Abdullah al-Sadiq was speaking from Hong Kong. He was arrested in Bangkok on April 2004. But in the months before, he was talking about it. Now, the British intelligence found out about this. And because he was using a British connection, and wrote a report saying that most likely the Tunisian's interlocutor in Asia was Abu Dhabi al-Sadr. So I had the opportunity to interview Abu Dhabi al-Sadr to know whether he was or not the case, and it was the case. But speaking of things that the tourists know and how important it is for them to go out for training and in conflict areas such as Syria or Iraq today. You remember the Bali 2002 attacks? My last interview for this book was with the deputy director of Indonesia's anti-terrorist, counter-terrorism police. Why? Because I knew that he was, in the year 2011, when the Bali bomber, the man who fabricated the Bali bombs, was arrested by the Pakistani authorities, remember?
Yeah,
exactly. He was allowed to interrogate him in Pakistan. So I talked to him and said, so he told you where he learned to use mobile phones for bomb-making purposes? I said, yes. So I named the camp where Assisi and another member of the Madrid bombing network, Said Barak, used to go, and that was the camp. And why is it important for me? Because in the Madrid bombings, the terrorists use, for the same purpose, the same brand and the same model of Mitsubishi cell phones as in the 2002 Bali bombings.
So the connections,
isn't that interesting?
The connections of the training camps, the globalness of the global jihad. I'm going to ask for questions from you in just 1 minute. 1 minute. I have one more question for Fernando myself. I can't help, however, but point out that the Indonesian you were talking about was arrested by the Pakistani authorities in Abbottabad, Pakistan, just a few months before Osama bin Laden met his deserved death in Abbottabad, Pakistan. And Umparik was in Abbottabad because he was looking to find Osama bin Laden. It seems that Indonesians knew where Osama bin Laden was hanging out, even if we are led to believe that the Pakistani government had no idea that he was in the front yard of their most important military academy. My last question is a very simple one. What is your estimate of the magnitude of fighters now going from Spain and other European countries to Syria and Iraq versus previous such migrations that we saw to Afghanistan back in the 1990s or to Bosnia or even to Iraq itself in the 2006 period?
Well, jihadist mobilization nowadays with respect to Syria and Iraq among jihadists, young jihadists in Europe, is far greater than what we knew with respect to Chechnya, Bosnia, and Afghanistan. Far greater. Nor even Mali attracted significant numbers. But Syria and Iraq that joint scenario is very different. It's having a dual impact on at an individual and a micro and a meso level. On an individual level, the Islamic State is providing motivations for joining the jihad based not just on emotions, hatred, and so on, not just on identity, which is also the case, but based on rational calculations. Many young people many young Muslims in Europe are galvanized by the Islamic State. They see the Islamic State as having success expectations, as winning territory, as winning things. An individual who was arrested recently in Spain, not the last operation, and I should say something about the last operation concerning a network of individuals radicalizing individuals in Spain and sending them to the Islamic State in Iraq. But the previous operation affected an individual who was based in Melilla, in a Spanish enclave in northern Morocco. And he used to tell the police during his declaration, you know, Al-Qaeda is just propaganda. They reach nothing. They talk a lot, but they reach nothing. We might say, well, they have different strategies and tactics. They don't speak about the caliphate. They speak about emirates, and we might discuss about it. But to them, it's too much talk, too little accomplishments. Whereas the Islamic State, you see these guys, they are now even reestablishing the caliphate, our ultimate goal. So this is galvanizing people on an individual base, and not just. On other types of motivation, but also introducing this very powerful motivation based on rational expectation, rational calculus, which adds to the other more salient motivations among individual jihadists in Europe, which is identity search. Didn't you notice that the countries in Europe most affected by this jihadist mobilization are those not Spain and Italy, but the UK, France, and Germany, particularly France, those where you have Muslim populations made out mainly by second and third generations? In those countries, chiefly among them France nowadays, is where the jihadists are more successful at mobilizing people. And this might sound anecdotic, but the last police operation in Spain, conducted a few weeks ago, dismantled a cell which was connected to the Islamic State, and the leader of this cell was a former member of Abu Dada's Al-Qaeda cell, who evaded arrest because on November 2001, he was in Afghanistan. So he was arrested shortly afterwards, but not by the Spanish police, by American troops. Sent him to Guantanamo, and then brought back to Spain to face justice. But since judges in Spain decided not to accept evidence coming from Afghanistan or Guantanamo as judicial evidence, he was set free. And he even went on to gatherings organized by Amnesty International to speak about, over the past years, to speak about Guantanamo and Afghanistan and so on. And finally, he was captured a few weeks ago, is now in prison. And interesting thing, he was no longer sided with Al-Qaeda. He was sided with the Islamists. Now, in Northern Africa, between Tunisia, Morocco, Libya, and Algeria, you have almost 50% of the foreign jihadist contingent in Syria and Iraq. Now, add 2,000 individuals around from Europe. So the large majority of individuals, we know the single country providing more jihadists to Syria and Iraq is Saudi Arabia. But as a geopolitical region, the Maghreb goes first, and then Europe. So where the epicenter of global terrorism, taking into consideration the competition between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, the epicenter of global terrorism is moving now to the Middle East. But the operational scenario for that terrorism focus is likely to be, in the coming years, North Africa and Western Europe.
Please identify yourself before you ask a question, and there's a microphone that'll come to you. This gentleman right here.
My name is Alexei Savchenko, and I have, can I ask two questions? Okay. The first question is, I have been to Spain after 2004. I have many friends, and it is my anecdotal observation. I might be wrong, and I would like to ask if I'm wrong, but many Spaniards reacting on these events said, we are innocent bystanders in the war between the United States and terrorists, and basically we have nothing to do with it. And the results of the elections after March 11, when the government of Aznar lost it abysmally, is sort of proving that Spaniards, that the terrorists achieved their goal, the regime change in Spain. Tell me, please, that I'm wrong. This is my first question. And the second one is completely different. You mentioned about Iraq and Al-Qaeda, Iran and Al-Qaeda cooperation, and I'm following this issue for a long time, and I'm completely confused. And you know, we know that Al-Qaeda is vehemently anti-Shia, and Al-Qaeda and Shia jihadists kill each other today in Iraq. However, they perfectly cooperate outside of it. Where is the border? Why do they cooperate in one place and kill each other in the other one? And when they decide to kill or cooperate, is there any pattern? Thank you.
Thank you very much for these two questions. If the second one relates to the fact that starting with that Amer al-Sisi was in Iran, working in Iran, when the Al-Qaeda cell that he belonged to was dismantled in Spain. Fact is, in those days, Iran was turning a blind eye towards Al-Qaeda operatives. And we know about Al-Qaeda individuals who were on house arrest there and prominent. So it was a geopolitical calculation on the part of the Iranian authorities affecting nearby countries. But it is well known that Al-Qaeda operatives were moving across Iran. Actually, the common route was to Afghanistan via Turkey and Iran. You see, when I had to travel throughout Spain, since my book was published late last February, to talk about the book, one of the most amazing facts that I realized is that Spaniards knew nothing, had no awareness of anything related to jihadist terrorism before 2003 or before 2004. When I ask the public in Spain, I mean, if they come to a presentation of my book, it is by definition an interested audience. When I ask them, do you know that one of the focal points for Al-Qaeda in Europe before 9/11 was Spain, Madrid, Granada, that's where the Al-Qaeda cell was established? Very few people know about that. Do you know that the Al-Qaeda cell in Spain was dismantled in this huge operation, the largest by far against Al-Qaeda post 9/11? Well, so from time to time, yes, I know, because I read in your book. Do you know that the first jihadist cell was dismantled in Spain on 1997 in Valencia. Not even in Valencia, I found a person who knew about this. And by the way, you know, again, with this issue of an independent cell made out of wannabes, self-radicalized individuals, you know, one of the members of the Madrid Bombing Network was arrested in Valencia in 1997 as part of this GIA cell, which was moving towards what later will be the GSPC. Well, I'm referring to Aleke Malamari. He was convicted, 14 years. He was incarcerated by a mistake on 2002. And you know what? As soon as those who were managing the formation of the Madrid Bombing Network knew about this, they went down to Valencia by car, broke him, and co-opted them into the network because they knew he had knowledge about explosives. I mean, he had been a member of the Algerian police. My fellow countrymen had no sensitivity to this, had no awareness whatsoever. This was a different case from the British one. So what happened? When the Madrid bombings took place, for my countrymen, that came out of the blue. And the way for them to make sense of this massacre was to relate it, to frame that into known things. What were those known things? ETA on the one side? It got to be ETA. Who else? Or Iraq on the other side. This should be because of Iraq. So this is why the issue became polarized and politicized from the very beginning. Now, my book shows very clearly that it was not ETA, which makes ETA no less a terrorist organization than ETA has been for all his criminal trajectory. On the other hand, it shows that the attacks against Spain were decided long before the elections and long before Iraq as revenge. Revenge. Even though the public in Spain was not aware of this, the police was very active against Al-Qaeda and jihadists. And a small part of what now is the structure that my country has preventing and combating international terrorism. In those days, it was a small central unit, with some people also working in Barcelona, some in Valencia, but that was not considered a nationwide problem. Now we have those units in every single province and major towns, particularly in the areas now more affected by, for instance, this Syria-Iraq-related jihadist mobilization. Madrid, Catalonia is a real serious problem within Europe as a whole, and the city of Ceuta in the other northern African Spanish enclave. So this is the reason why the issue was politicized from the very beginning. Now, yes, Al-Qaeda and jihadists in general present the Madrid bombings as a victory. The blessed battle of Madrid, our victory. Yes, I know. And you cannot doubt that the attacks had an impact on the elections. There's not a huge impact. There was just a few percentual points, not a huge, just a few. Enough for one of the parties to gain a relative majority of seats in the parliament. Now, you know, that party, I don't want to politicize this issue, that party had in its electoral program this promise of withdrawing troops from Iraq in case of electoral victory. And it was to comply. It was intended to, the decision to withdraw troops was intended to comply with that electoral promise. By the way, neither the Popular Party nor the Socialist Party had any point in their respective electoral programs concerning the threat of international terrorism. That was not in the public agenda. That was not in the political agenda. Interesting, isn't it? So, why is it that Al-Qaeda, and this is a real fact, so please, if you are sympathetic to one or the other party, do not misunderstand me in this point. No? You can say they all disregarded a threat which was real. At the beginning of 2003, February 2003, I completed a book which was titled Global Terrorism. And this book was intended to familiarize my country, fellow people, with this real threat for our societies. And it is in this book that I wrote that the way I was seeing, as a result of police operations in Spain, the way I was seeing jihadism evolving, marked a departure from logistical supportive activities to increasingly operational capabilities, among other things because of the number of individuals who are being sent abroad to learn and practice terrorism. And my conclusion was Spain was to be targeted by these people inside the territory. Long before they were... No, just my last point. Why is it that Al-Qaeda is selling this as a victory? Because of a political mistake, I think. Which was the mistake? The new prime minister, as a result of the elections following the attacks, decided that he never had any office. He was just a parliamentarian. He was never city mayor. He was never regional governor. He was never minister. So you might attribute to his lack of experience internally and international affairs what he did. Although I know that he was following an ethic of conviction. Max Weber used to call it ethic of conviction. So it's nothing to blame him in this respect. However, the first decision that he took after taking office, the very first decision, and he took the decision solemnly, was to announce the withdrawal of troops in Iraq. No problem with that, except that he did so 5 weeks after 991 people killed in Madrid. Only 5 weeks afterwards. Without referring then to the allies in Iraq, the US, the British, and so on. So it is difficult for people outside of Spain, unfamiliar with particulars of Spanish politics, not to establish a causal link between the attacks and the decision.
Sure.
And so regardless of what the new prime minister had in mind, out of Spain it became not only for jihadists, for my colleagues, a given that Al-Qaeda succeeded because Spain withdrew troops following the 3/11 attacks in Spain.
I can't help but note that there was another party that had an interest in the mythology of the lone wolf and the self-radicalized and that Al-Qaeda was dead, and that was, of course, the American government, which had proclaimed the demise of Al-Qaeda in the winter of 2001 and 2002. even when the London bombings took place in 7/7 in July 2005, the argument was made by the Bush administration, this is another self-radicalized cell. Now, of course, when Ayman Zawahiri was able to produce the martyrdom videos of two of the bombers, it became harder and harder to live with the notion that they weren't any way connected to Al-Qaeda. I think we still have a lot of problems on this issue.
Bruce, may I add something with respect to this? Because before I mention what Iraq and Syria, how this is all impacting jihadist mobilization at the micro level of the level of motivations. But I forgot to say that at the meso level, what you can tell from within Europe is that events in Syria and Iraq, and particularly action on the part of the Islamic State, is providing jihadists with renewed leadership, organization, and strategy. I mean, individuals who got radicalized, they don't want to become lone wolves. What they want is to become part of that big thing which is taking place, the Islamic State or whatever. They don't want to be independent jihadists.
Right.
They want to be part of it. They revalue now organization, leadership, and strategy. That what the Islamic State in particular, the not only, is offering them.
This gentleman right here.
Thank you very much, Herbert Regenbogen. Globalization of terrorism. If we fast forward towards today's conditions in Spain, and we look over the last 2 years as authorities have dealt with criticism of Islam and of the ideology that is a part of this terrorism. There are individuals who have been, over the course of the 2 years, in the case of a Pakistani seeking asylum in Spain, to be deported because of his publications of portraying Islam as something which is categorized as a hate crime. I forget the individual's name at this moment. But my question is, how does the authorities in Spain want to deal with these kind of civil unrest? And are they in a position of denying the real conflict which will emerge between these kind of portrayals of Islam, because the authorities are primarily interested that the country will not become a target of Islamic terrorists, especially in light of some of their own citizens returning from the Middle East?
I will not be speaking about civil unrest. And I'm not sure I follow it properly, the meaning of your comment and question. But Spain is not a country where survey data shows that Islamophobia is prominent. In this case, you have other countries where the problem is more real. France, for instance. Spain is having a hard time dealing with Muslim communities. But the main reason for this is the division between Muslims in the country. Most of Muslims in Spain are foreigners. They come from Morocco, they come from Algeria, They come from Pakistan. By the way, among all those who are arrested and convicted, Moroccans are well underrepresented, despite the large majority of Muslims living in Spain. And Algerians, and to a lesser extent, Pakistanis, are well overrepresented. So Algerians and Moroccans basically tie when it comes to individuals arrested and convicted. And yet we have in Spain 17 times more Moroccans than Algerians. Mm. But this, obviously, this goes back to the trajectory of jihadism in Spain, as in Italy, as in France. The Algerians play a prominent role since the 90s. So Spain is having trouble dealing with the Muslim communities, and therefore with engaging the Muslim communities in preventing radicalization within the country, mostly because of these internal divisions. Very difficult issue to solve. Very difficult issue to solve. Now, the problem is basically nowadays with three segments of the Muslim population. Those who are first generation immigrants, aged between 30 and 40. Those who are emerging second generations, it is only as from last year that I have students at my university in Madrid who are the sons or the daughters of Moroccans or Algerians in the country. But there's a vulnerable segment of these people between 15 and 25 or so, approximately. And then now we are experiencing precisely as a result of the Iraq-Syria conflict, or the conflict in Syria and Iraq, we are now seeing how jihadist terrorism in Spain is becoming a real home ground phenomenon. Why? Because we see Spaniards by birth or individuals who underwent the school socialization process in the country, now engaging in jihadist activities and being arrested or being sent to Syria and so on. That was not the case before. The Madrid bombings, I mean, that was not a home ground threat. I mean, a home ground plot. Those individuals were foreigners, radicalized even before the 9/11 attacks, at least half of them, 70% of them before the Iraq war, and only those delinquents or former delinquents were radicalized as from the start of the Iraq conflict. It is expected for the Spanish government to announce within days, officially, the Spanish strategy against international terrorism and for radicalization prevention. In my country, contrary to what the home security culture is in the US or in Canada or in the UK or in the Netherlands, that strategy until now is secret. And this is a real problem, obviously, because a secret document is not the good basis for you to go out and engage civil society, right? Something secret, so leave me away. Huh? I don't want to be engaged. So we go to Delcano, actually, we have been insisting on the importance of having this open to the public, because look at our experience in Spain. I mean, you have to educate people on the real threat, not to alarm, not to exaggerate, just to give real facts about the threat. And then you have to educate people on what are the measures and why are you taking those measures and how those measures will be financed and evaluated in order to prevent, now in particular, this home, increasing home ground threat. So this document is about to be, we guess, is about to be public, and probably will be writing something also in English at the Elcano Royal Institute website to help American and speaking English speaking audiences to make sense of that particular initiative on the part of the Spanish government, which is still perhaps the case in my country. That, you know, we tend to, my fellow Spaniards, when thinking about jihadists, they think about Maghrebis. So they quickly associate terrorism and social exclusion and poverty and so on. And Spaniards should be the last ones in the world to associate terrorism and social exclusion, marginalization, and poverty. Why? Because ETA members of ETA terrorist organizations, were middle class, well-educated individuals coming from rather well-to-do families of the richest region in the country. So we should be the last one. This means that we learn our institution, when analyzing the radicalization process, the where, the when, and how of radicalization, jihadist radicalization process in the country, we know that socioeconomic aspects are significant but not determinant. We have as many individuals college educated as having no formal education. We have as many businessmen as unemployed individuals. This diversity is telling you something. This and the fact that all jihadists in my country come from just 5 cities is telling us something. The phenomenon is not uniformly distributed. So what happens, it is because an ideological agent is operating at a particular place, usually a metropolitan area. And therefore, exposition to jihadist ideology, intense and durable, is far more important to understand jihadist radicalization and recruitment than socioeconomic conditions.
We have time, I'm sorry, for just one more question. Back here.
Thank you for your time. Very quickly, looking ahead to future threats in the global jihadist realm, what areas of the world do you think are primed to be a part of this hub that we aren't currently thinking about? And I'm thinking about the recent BBC News report of French activity in the Sahel region of Africa and the proactive measures they're taking to try to stem Islamist threats in that area. Would you agree that that is a valid concern by the French to proactively move in that region? And are there other locations that we should be thinking about as well?
Thank you. A very interesting question. I should reply from a European perspective. The Middle East, that is Syria, Iraq, is for Europeans becoming the focus of jihadist terrorism threat. Departing from South Asia, as it used to be in the past. But the intervening variable, not the focus, the source, is to be found among jihadist organizations in the Maghreb and Sahel. And this is, incidentally, we should expect in the Maghreb and Sahel the current competition between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State to be reproduced with more intensity than in any other region of the world. Yes, you may find pro-Islamic State organizations in South Asia, but they are likely to side the Taliban, the Afghan, the Pakistani Taliban, they are more likely to side with Al-Qaeda. That will also hold true for the Horn of Africa. So the place where that competition is going to be reproduced is there, in is just across the border from my country and from Italy and from France. And Sara Sharia, Tunisia, and Sara Sharia, Libya, already sided with Islamic State. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is sided with Al-Qaeda, but we already have some sub-commanders and not that significant individuals, but they are ready to express that they prefer the Islamic State. And it is the Islamic State as a whole galvanizing the vast majority, for instance, those individuals who deported from Morocco. The vast majority are with the Islamic State, particularly after April 2013. The vast majority of those individuals who were recruited in Libya are sided with the Islamic State. The vast majority of individuals recruited in Tunisia, which is a very interesting case, are sided with the Islamic State. And 60% approximately of those individuals radicalized and recruited in Algeria, which is Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb home. Nor even there, Al-Qaeda is winning the hearts and minds of these young people. The Islamic State is becoming prominent. And therefore, the Algerian authorities already know that al-Baghdadi has named the person who already moved from the Middle East to somewhere in the Maghreb and Sahel area with the mission to articulate in Europe, in connection with Northern Africa, the following for the Islamic State. And I guess the Spanish, the French intelligence, the Italians, and the Maghrebians are now trying to track this particular individual and his purposes.
I want to tell you all the good news, which is my understanding is this is already translated into English and will be published hopefully next year in English, so that those of you who are Spanish deprived will have your opportunity to get all of the details. Fernando, I want to thank you very much for a most stimulating. I think we could go on. I know I could ask you questions for the rest of the afternoon. Thank you again for coming here, and thank all of you for joining us. And I promise when we go back to Brookings in the fall, the air conditioning system works better over there. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.